This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 191. This podcast is brought to you by Health IQ. Health IQ uses science and data to negotiate lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people. Research shows that marathon runners have a 29% lower risk of mortality. So let Health IQ get you the life insurance rate you deserve. For a free rate quote, visit healthiq.com/MTA. That's healthiq.com/MTA.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where it's all about empowering and inspiring you to take your running to the next level. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we speak with Ian Sharman, the winner of the 2016 Leadville Trail 100 Ultra Marathon. You're going to hear Ian describe what it's like to run 100 miles and what to tell yourself when the going gets tough, no matter what distance you're training for. And in this episode's quick tip, we recommend sandals that help with recovery after a run and also dealing with plantar fasciitis. And to get more help in your running goals, find out how to train with us and our awesome online community when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com. All right, Angie. Well, by the time people are listening to this podcast episode, if they're listening to it as soon as it goes out, we might be in Germany by then, getting ready to run the Berlin Marathon. It's exciting. We'll take along our handy digital recorder and maybe capture some sounds to put on our race recap episode that we'll do, hopefully, if everything goes well, right?
Can't wait. Speaking of the digital recorder.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. You're not so enthusiastic about having a digital recorder put in front of your face.
Although I've shoved it in front of enough people's faces that I should get a taste of my own medicine.
Yes. It's going to be great. Well, it's exciting to have Ian Sharman back on the podcast. It's been a couple years since we had him on as a guest, and he continues to just kill it out there in the world of ultramarathons. And we do like to talk with ultramarathoners from time to time, because even though I've never run an ultra myself, Angie, you have run a few, but even though I have never done it, it still gives me perspective. If I'm out there, let's say I have to do a 20-mile training run or do a marathon, I just think about how much further these people are running than me, and it really puts things in perspective.
Yes, it does.
Well, we want to get right into the interview today, but before we do that, we're going to read a couple shout-outs. It's exciting to hear what people have going on, and hope this encourages you.
This note comes from Addie in the Academy. She says, "This morning I ran a half marathon down the same canyon I did my first marathon 1 year ago today. I can't believe all I've accomplished in the last year. 3 marathons, including Boston, 4 half marathons, and I placed in the top 3 of 5 of those races. It goes to show that if you put the work in and train smart, you can do anything you put your mind to, no matter how old you are. I started my running journey 2.5 years ago as a way to escape life. I knew that if I could lace up my shoes and go for a run, I could fight through the pain of my divorce. I never imagined where it would take me. I love to run in the way it makes me feel. Today I ran my fastest half marathon in 1 hour and 26 minutes. I came in 3rd in my age group and 50th overall out of 2,800 runners. In a few more weeks, I'm running the St. George Marathon and hope to run my best time yet. Thank you everyone for your support, especially Trevor and Angie. I couldn't have done it without you."
Well, thank you for that nice comment. And it's interesting to think that, you know, she just started running 2.5 years ago. So there were, you know, most of her life, she didn't even know that there'd be this whole component, this major component to her life that she would develop. It just goes to show you, like, how, who knows what we're capable of and how our life can change as we go. I like to think that our best days are always in the future.
And I think she's experiencing that now, being over 40 now and, you know, experiencing some fast marathon times and, you know, just knowing that great things are ahead. I think it's, you know, very true what she said. No matter how old you are, you can do anything you put your mind to. This next note is from Sasha in the Academy. She says, "I squeaked my first full marathon in just under 4 hours at 3 hours, 58 minutes, and 50 seconds at the Via Marathon. Thank you, everyone, for your words of encouragement and inspiration."
Well, that's an awesome finishing time for the first marathon. So congrats, Sasha. And she says that she squeaked under 4 hours, but I think people have squeaked with a lot less wiggle room.
That's pretty comfortable sub-4-hour finish.
Yeah, 3:58:50, not bad.
This next note comes from Alyssa in the Academy. She says, "Today marked my first marathon. the Lehigh Valley Via Marathon, just like Sasha was. It started out a little rough since my iPod Shuffle was dead. Then around mile 9, I tripped over a root on the trail. Just a little blood and open wound on my wrist and hips. However, I was not going to let these setbacks hinder my ability to enjoy the race. Overall, this is one of the first races where I have tried to embrace the fun and enjoy the run throughout. And I did. Like I mentioned before, part of the battle is mindset, but it's how we persevere through that makes a huge difference. I have to give the MTAers a shout-out for helping me change my thinking and stay positive all throughout. Special shout-out to Mitch, Kelly, and John for keeping me level-headed the day before and day of the race. You guys are awesome.
Well, what a great attitude to have, you know, throughout a marathon. Just enjoy the race, and if you, you know, something unexpected happens, like, you know, you fall, don't let it ruin your whole day. I mean, I've definitely seen people fall on the course before, and it's I always hate seeing that. But yeah, she definitely handled it very well. So congrats, Alyssa, on accomplishing your first marathon, doing it with style, and we're proud of you.
That's right. And this next note comes from Kelly. She also ran her first marathon. She says, wow, I actually did it. I ran a marathon. This time last year, I was in the final weeks of training for a 5K. A lot can be accomplished in a year. I finished the Lehigh Valley Marathon in 5 hours and 4 minutes. I was hoping for under 5 hours, but it was incredibly hot, and I'm extremely proud just to have finished. I really want to thank the entire MTA community. So now for the big question, what should I sign up for next?
Wow, that's great. Now talk about another successful first marathon. With so many races going on right now in the fall, I love to see all these reports come in. I mean, give me a big bowl of that every weekend. That's great.
Great inspiration, that's for sure.
So congrats, Kelly, on running your first marathon. It sounds like you trained well, and now you're eager to do another one. So that's awesome. That's exactly what we're trying to achieve here at MTA, is make this a lifestyle kind of thing.
That's right. And this last note is from JD. He says, dear Angie and Trevor, I've had a great summer full of amazing runs, and I'd like to thank you because your podcast gave me the initial kick in the bum I needed to start training for my very first ultra, specifically episode 149, Lessons from My First Ultra Marathon. Last weekend, I completed a 50K trail race at the Squamish 50 event. But hey, not bad for someone who's never even run a marathon before. You guys gave me one of the mantras I kept repeating to myself to help through a pretty hard course. Finish strong and injury-free, and that's exactly what I did. And he says, I thought you'd like to know you have listeners from Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, Canada. We may very well be some of your northernmost listeners.
Yeah, I'll say, wow, Yellowknife. I've looked on the map at Yellowknife quite a few times, and I've traveled through the Yukon, so I've thought about the Northwest Territories and just how remote places are up there in Canada. But that's great, and goes along perfect with this interview because we're talking about ultramarathons. So thanks for that wonderful note, JD. Keep up the good work. And by the way, we greet everyone who is listening to us in Canada. And we got some folks in the Academy from Canada as well. MTA, it's everywhere you want to be.
Some places you might not want to be.
Well, we're going to get into our interview with Ian Sharman. Ian is originally from Great Britain. He lives in the States now. And he is probably the most consistent presence in the world of ultra marathons. He always finishes in the top 10 at Western States. He's run over 200 ultras and marathons in over 30 countries globally. He has won the Leadville Trail 100 three times. But even if you're not an ultra runner, I know you're going to enjoy what Ian has to say because a lot of it's mindset and training tactics that you can use at the marathon distance as well. So let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Ian Sharman right now. Okay, we're on the podcast now with Ian Sharman, talking to us from Bend, Oregon. And Ian, you just had a birthday recently, right?
I did, yeah. So I've got an August birthday, which means that it always coincides with a whole load of amazing races, no matter which one I pick.
I think you're younger than me. How old are you?
36 now.
Okay, oh, I'm 36.
Same age.
Yeah. But you make me feel old, man, when I look at what you do and what you've accomplished.
You can keep doing this thing forever. I mean, I think there's a guy at Leadville who was 72, I believe, who finished. There's a couple of people in the early 70s who've finished at Western States as well.
Yeah.
There's no reason you can't keep doing this for pretty much forever.
That's good to know. So take us back to the beginning. It's been a while. We were talking before we started, officially started, that it's been a while since you've been on our podcast, back in 2013, and some people might remember that interview. But take us back and tell us how you got started in this this crazy world of ultra running.
Well, I now feel like I've been around it for quite a while, because it was 2005 that I first started. And so I basically saw a TV show about the Marathon des Sables race in the Sahara Desert. I wasn't a runner, but I was just feeling like I was living in London. I felt like I wasn't getting enough exercise, so I needed some kind of incentive to head towards. And that adventure side of things appealed to me. So I started running and just got a bit hooked. And then I started knocking out 30 marathons a year for a few years. I do a bit less than that now, mainly because I do more ultras than road races and marathons. But I've basically been running quite a lot of races every year for a decade.
I remember one of the things that we talked to you last was that you can run a very fast half and full marathon. You know, sometimes it's hard to mix being able to be competitive in that and then ultra running as well. So I was very impressed with that.
Well, it doesn't feel like it, though. I mean, everything is relative, because I've got guys in town who do like a 103 half marathon. One of my good friends, he's done a 101. So I look at that and I think, okay, that is quick. And then I've done like a 115 half, which feels super quick to me. And to, you know, most marathoners and half marathoners, that sounds fast. But it's just all where your perspective is. You know, who your friends are, what kind of things you tend to do.
That's a good point. Good point.
So what is your fastest marathon time?
2:32. Oh, that's from way back in 2009. So I had hoped to actually try and improve that this year, but I just don't think I'm going to have time. So at some point, before I get too old and start slowing down.
Nice.
You've still got a while.
Yeah.
So you moved over here to the States to get married, right?
Yeah, 2010 I got married, moved over here late 2009. I actually got that marathon PR about 1 month after living in the US. It's like, wow, this is great. This is clearly good for me coming over here. So yeah, I mean, I lived between Oregon and California, the Bay Area, California, moving back and forth a few times, both huge ultra running communities. Mm. So Bend has a whole load of sponsored top level ultra runners, as well as athletes of all different types. We also have in the Bay Area, obviously, you know, a lot of top level ultra runners, particularly in the Mill Valley kind of area in Marin. I wasn't quite there, but there's just so many ultras and so much trail racing in general there that it really does rub off on you. And it's actually partly because of that I got into 100 miling. Mm. So I did about 5 years of doing long distance races before I even dared do a 100 miler. And then I'm living in the US for a few months and I'm thinking, it doesn't seem to count unless you do a 100 miler here. You're not really an ultra runner. And I know that is not really how it is, but that was the perception that I had of it. So I thought I better enter the Western States lottery, and I got in the first time. Mm-hmm. So I did that one in 2010 and realized, well, at the time I realized that they were horrible and I never wanted to do them again. But soon afterwards, I realized that my endurance seemed to be best suited to that longer kind of distance, that it's not quite sharp enough for the like a marathon and a 50K and those kind of distances where, like I was saying, there's these guys now who are Olympic trials qualifiers and there's just so much leg speed there.
So you usually finish in the top 10 at Western States. At your first Western States, how did you place?
I was eighth that year. So I've been top 10 every time. So that one, I came into it, I was in good shape. I mean, it was a year after I got my marathon PR. I did my fastest 50 miler about a month before. So I knew that I could probably do a decent time there, as long as all the things that can go wrong don't go wrong. And there were only little minor hiccups that slowed it down. So it turned out to be a pretty good race. But that is the slowest one I've done there. I was very conservative in that race to make sure I'd finish. That was my priority.
Is Western States harder than Leadville? Or is that even a good question to ask?
They're just difficult in different ways. I think it depends on what your body's suited to. If you're really bad at running in the heat, Western States is harder. If you're really bad at running at altitude, Leadville is harder. In terms of the terrain, not a whole lot between them. There's a little bit more climbing at Western States, but they're similar, and they tend to have similar finish times as well. Western States is usually a little bit quicker. But they're both tough. Like every race you ever do in your life is tough. Like 5K for me, I think, is the hardest distance, because it's just high intensity and suffering. And, you know, slowing down 5 seconds a mile is a big deal. So I think whatever race you do, as long as you're doing your best in it, it is a hard race.
We've had other people tell us that. I think Shalane Flanagan, who we interviewed a couple episodes ago, told us that.
I'm not surprised. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see her do ultras. Like, she's probably got a few more years of marathoning, but I've not had any luck convincing other top-level marathoners to do it. I tweeted to Paula Radcliffe immediately after she said she was retiring and said, hey, why not do some ultras? No response. I chatted to Dina Caster at the finish line. She was, you know, one of the celebs, basically, at the Big Sur Marathon a couple of years ago, and said to her, you know, now that you've maybe moving on from marathons, what about ultras? And she's definitely getting into trails, at least, but I'd love to see, you know, people who have been to the Olympics and that kind of caliber move over, even if it is their second career and after they've kind of retired.
That makes me curious. Celebrities in the marathon world and shorter distances, how do they view celebrities like yourself in the ultra world?
I don't really know who we are at all. I mean, it's celebrity is a relative term there. It's, if I go to a Western States or a Leadville, a group of people will recognize me. Mm-hmm. If I walk down the street, no one's going to recognize me. So it's not like them. I mean, they're on TV, they're on the Olympics. They are much more familiar, but still only to running geeks, really.
Exactly.
You know, your average person isn't going to know who Shalane Flanagan is, but every runner in America who is at least semi-serious probably has an idea.
Mm-hmm. Whereas they wouldn't know who the top ultra runners are.
I think maybe a couple of people, like Dean Canazis has a big profile just as a general runner. Someone like Killian, I think in Europe, has such a big profile that other people know who he is. I saw a few years ago, Paula Radcliffe and Killian were doing some kind of run for whatever sponsor commitment. So, you know, there is a little bit of overlap, but generally, no.
All right. So who do you think right now is at the top of the ultra world? You mentioned Killian. And I guess for those that don't know some of the names, like who else would you say?
Besides yourself, of course.
Yes.
Well, it depends on what distances and types of terrain you're talking about. I mean, sure. I think I'm a 100-mile guy. I wouldn't really put myself as being up there with some of those other types of race and shorter races at all. The guys at the moment who've probably done the most impressive stuff in North America recently are Rob Krah. He won Western States twice. He won Leadville. He's Ultra Runner of the Year 2 years in a row, and he's had some injuries in the last year or so that meant he hasn't done as much, but I mean, he's as good as anyone out there. There's Jim Walmsley this year, who's really got to the top of his game, getting a load of course records. He was winning at Western States for 93 miles, then goes off course, on a few extra miles, and then walks it in for 20th place, I think.
Wow.
So there's some super fast guys, and these are guys who have fast track backgrounds. I think Jim's a sub 14 minute 5K runner. Rob's done like a 4 minute mile. So these guys have got a lot of leg speed as well as the ability to push through and have that endurance.
So you won the Leadville Trail 100 miler about 2 weeks ago, and this is the third time you've taken first place. Angie did the Leadville Trail Marathon last year. She says it was the most difficult marathon she's ever done.
Especially coming from 300 feet above sea level.
That's the biggest challenge. You know, it's one thing to, like if you did a hot race and you did no heat training, it's going to be 10 times harder. Coming directly from sea level, that race is going to be hard anyway because it's up at 10,000 feet and above in Leadville. But that would not be an easy race to do. I'd rather do a flat marathon or even a mountainy marathon without the altitude because the intensity is so much higher that makes it a lot tougher. So I don't live particularly high up. I've always lived at sea level. I now live about 3,500 feet up, which is basically the same as sea level. I mean, it doesn't have any real effect. It doesn't give me any training benefit. But I have to go up to the high mountains and get up above 10,000 feet for a couple of weeks before a race like Leadville to have a chance of having a good run there. Because it's all between 9,200 and 12,600 feet. So, you know, that's just nothing like my normal running. And when I go there the first couple of days, it just hits you and you've got little headaches and it feels so difficult. But the body adapts. And that's one of the things I've enjoyed the most about everything I've done through running is how well the body can adapt to any stresses you put on it. Hmm. You can overstress it and get overtrained or injured, but basically the body is capable of adapting to heat, to cold, to altitude, to any type of terrain, to anything you really want to put it through.
So take us to Leadville this year, kind of walk us through the race, give us a sense of what it's like to run 100 miles through the mountains. And, you know, we're talking about extreme elevation here. Kind of give us a blow-by-blow, so to speak.
Sure. So it's an out-and-back 50-mile route. You've basically got three climbs on the way out and those same climbs on the way back, which are steeper on the way back. It's a higher gradient. So I've done it four times now with three of them as the wins, and one of them was basically the same time, but I came third. And so it starts off in the dark. You've got about 2 hours of darkness. It's some easy stuff early on. Like, you go gently downhill for a few miles, then you run around a lake, and then you start the first climb at about mile 14 or 15. And so at that point, I think I was running in second with a few other people. Max King, the world 100K champion from a couple of years ago, an American record holder, who conveniently lives half a mile away from me. He was in the lead. So
he just
pulling away. Yeah. I don't do that many runs with him because he's too quick. yeah. I mean, he's a 2:14 marathoner, so a speed session for him is not something that I can match. And so I expected him to be ahead because he's a very fast guy. And I think he's about 4 minutes ahead at the half marathon stage, the next aid station maybe 10 minutes ahead. So he was gradually pulling away, and I had a few guys around me, but I was pretty much in second the whole day. Then there's just lots of flat running. Then you get to another kind of gentle climb up to about mile 37 or 38. And then you go down a bit steeper into an aid station. And then there's the main part of the race, which is called Hope Pass, which you do two times. So you go up from 9,200 feet to 12,600 in about 4 miles. That's the bit that really makes or breaks the race for people. And it's by far the most scenic part of the race. And then you come down even steeper the other side, go into an aid station, turn around and come right back up Hope Pass again. And so the fact that you go up that high twice tends to make a lot of people, it either wipes out their legs, makes their stomach go bad, they get altitude issues. Luckily, I found that hasn't tended to be the case for me, and that's partly from the 2 weeks of being up there each time. So Max was still in the lead then. I was comfortably alone in second, and I caught up a little bit over Hope Pass. I think I was 12 minutes behind at that same aid station on the way back at mile 60.
You guys running up Hope Pass or death marching?
Not really.
Or what?
No, I mean, the backside of Hope Pass is about a 20% gradient, varying a little bit. But for 2.5 miles of 20% gradient, I could run maybe quarter of a mile at that, and then I'd be like heart rate through the roof. So, and that's if I hadn't already run 50 miles. So no, that is very much hiking. But the thing is, the difference between a good hike and a slower hike is a pretty significant pace. I mean, if I'm doing about a 20-minute mile up there, some of the people at the back might be doing a one-hour mile. So it could take a couple of hours to go up that ascent, and lots of stopping, and you can lose a lot of time there. But then, yeah, coming down the other side, I was feeling great. I like Hope Pass typically because it's a tough part of the race, but it forces everyone to hike, and it makes most people really tired afterwards. But I've usually been feeling pretty good afterwards. So I'm thinking, great, I'm catching Max. I've got 40 miles to catch him. No rush. Let's just stick to the plan, keep doing the tortoise and the hare type of race. But then the next aid station, 10 miles later, about mile 70, he'd doubled his lead. He was about 24 minutes ahead. So I started thinking that he wasn't going to slow down and that he might just hold on to it. And he was under the course record pace for most of the day.
Wow.
So I was getting a little bit demoralized at that point, especially when it got to the second to last aid station. There was 24 miles left and he was 24 minutes up.
Wow.
So it didn't look like that was going to happen unless something went really wrong for him. But the funny thing in this type of race, you get kind of sporadic updates. So when you go back along the course, you're seeing all the other runners and they're giving you updates and they're telling you what other people look like. And particularly coming down Hope Pass, you see most of the people there. And so every couple of seconds, I see another person. And one person would say, oh, he's 10 minutes ahead. Then 1 minute later, 20 minutes ahead. Like, you guys have no idea.
Oxygen it could be deprivation.
Any, yeah, he is ahead was the only thing that I knew. And they'd say, he's looking good, or he's looking bad, or he's flying. And it's just such contrasting things you're hearing the whole time. Huh. Although at each aid station, my crew was saying that he was looking like he was struggling a little bit. But ultimately, how you look and how you feel are two different things. I've known lots of really good 100-mile racers who can look like death all day long, and yet they keep going at a good pace. And then other people who can look great, and they're actually feeling like they're about to collapse. And so outwardly, you can't tell, but they're just about to faint or something. So yeah, 24 miles left. About 4 miles later, I caught him, and he was just lying by the side of the trail
on the
final climb. Yeah, just lying, not in the middle of the trail, but by the side with his pacer sat up, hands on knees, and he wasn't vomiting or anything like that. He just was basically like he collapsed almost. So I checked that he was okay. I had a pacer with me, and I was a bit concerned that we might need to get some medical attention for him. Luckily, that wasn't the case. He was more concerned about where third place was so that he would get caught. So when he's in that mindset, you know he can't be too bad, at least. He's right. With it, and he probably doesn't need the ambulance just yet. But, I mean, he'd gone at such a fast pace going under that course record, which is one of the hardest course records in the ultra world.
Matt Carpenter's record, right?
Matt Carpenter from 2005. No one's come within, I think one person's been within half an hour. So that's the closest anyone's been. And so I was thinking at that point, okay, well, this is not how I wanted to pass him, but now I've got to really put my head down in case he starts feeling better in 5 minutes. So at that point, you start running scared. I have to assume, because I don't know any better, that he is back to running super fast and feeling great, and he just had a low patch. That wasn't the case in the end, but it kept me moving faster and gave me an incentive to push. And then in the final miles, I was just all on my own with a pacer, but with no real idea of exactly where he was, but just knowing he wasn't too close. And so I was pushed just to try and get a little bit quicker than the times I've done there before. Finished it in 16:22. And so my other times have been between 16:30 and 16:41. So all really close together. I've been, it's ridiculous how close my splits, even at all the aid stations, have been those 4 years. Yeah. And I think Max, unfortunately, had to walk it in that last 20 miles. So he ended up coming ninth in about 19 hours 50. So he dropped about 3.5 hours in that last 20 miles from the point that I saw him. And that's the kind of thing that I think shorter distance runners don't always appreciate about a 100-miler, is that if you bonk in a marathon, you lose a few minutes. If you have to walk in a couple of miles, it doesn't add that much to your time. In a 100-miler, if you've got 20 miles left and you're really feeling bad, you can add on so much time that it doesn't matter what your splits were earlier. It's not just marginal differences. I mean, he dropped from first to ninth. But even still, I mean, he walked for 20 miles and only 8 people passed him. So it shows how far ahead he was and how well he was running. But I mean, I was relieved coming into town. I try and enjoy it at least that last mile or so. You don't have to panic at that point because you can see behind you at least half a mile. So I knew that if I couldn't see anyone, I'd won. But it's not until about mile 99 that I can feel like that. Until then, it's just running scared, just trying to keep everything from going bad and having to push just in case someone is doing really well right behind.
So if you were Max King and majorly bonked like he did, what would you have done in his situation?
I would just try and finish and do the best I could from that point, which is what he did. I mean, he did keep trying to run. So I've spoken to him afterwards and chatted through it. Every time he tried to run, it's just like his body had nothing and he had to immediately go back to a walk. So he was resigned to finishing. And still a big deal at Leadville is you've got two buckles. There's the final cutoff for getting under 30 hours, and then there's also the sub 25 hour, but bigger buckle that is really coveted. It's very difficult to get. So Max still had the incentive to you know, do his best race, and that's exactly what I would do. It's if things really go horrible, you want to make sure you can still finish at all costs, except if you're going to medically damage yourself. So if you've broken a bone or something, you know, call it a day. But otherwise, if you're just suffering, you've got to keep yourself moving to still get that finish. And he still finished under 20 hours, which is a very fast time.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a lot slower than he would have done otherwise.
So there's lots of people that bonk in the marathon. What are some of the things that people can tell themselves when they feel like quitting, you know, when their body is just screaming at them?
It's definitely a different mentality in the shorter stuff compared to the longer, because firstly, your intensity's got to stay higher. So when you bonk in the marathon, it's not like you start walking typically. You still want to keep running and ideally not too far away from the pace you were already running. So sometimes it's just a case of easing off a little bit. Drop 15, maybe 30 seconds a mile. See if that makes it a bit easier. Try and eat some food and tell yourself it will get better. And ultras really teach you this well, that you can bonk multiple times and come out the other side every time and then be able to run well again. So it's not like once you hit mile 18 or 20 or whenever you hit the wall in the marathon that you're done, right, and that it's going to be horrible the whole way in. It might be if you were going too hard and you've blown up completely, then it might remain hard the whole way. But if you're hitting a more standard kind of typical wall that every run is going to hit within a marathon, then just tell yourself that it's okay to slow down just marginally for a couple of miles and that you'll come out the other side. But try and get some food, you know, gels, something simple like that. Get a bit of simple energy in and just keep yourself moving. And ultimately, although it can feel like there's an eternity left in the race, if you've got 6 miles left in a marathon, mm-hmm. it actually helps so much within an ultra, where that same context could be that there's 10 hours left and you're feeling horrible, or 20 or 40 hours. You know, the length of the race can be almost infinite. There's a 3,100 mile race around a 1 mile loop in New York each summer. So, you know, there's always something longer and tougher. So you can imagine those people probably bonk quite a lot. And they probably have a lot of low patches in a race like that. Yeah. But as long as they keep moving, they come out the other side and they've got a lot of miles to cover. So let's say you're at mile 20, you bonk. Just tell yourself that, you know, this is what makes the marathon kind of a big deal. The fact that it isn't easy. It's about fitness to a large extent, but also how well you can tactically run it, how well you can pace it, how well you can look after yourself. And so that's why it means so much to finish the marathon. Although admittedly, that's become a more commonplace thing these days, and hence more people moving to things like Ironman and ultras. But it's the same mentality that you've got to be looking after yourself and finding a way to stay positive and motivated no matter what happens in the race. Too many people, I think, they have an A goal, and then as soon as that doesn't look like it's possible, whether it's time or position or whatever, then the motivation just disappears. Yeah. So, for example, if you're aiming to win a race and second place feels like your first loser and you're really that ambitious, then if you drop to second, suddenly you can lose all motivation, or you drop to third and you just don't care anymore. And I think that's a fairly common thing amongst top level racers. But it's equally the same for someone who's middle of the pack and they're aiming for a PR. Then they're at mile 20, they lose a few seconds, they don't think they're going to get it anymore, and they just jog it in because they no longer care about the time. So I think one of the biggest skills about endurance running is being able to deal with the reality of how things are going rather than how your best case scenario would be in your head. So that you go, you know, let's say you slow down, you've hit the wall, things are feeling worse than you expect. Then you say, okay, well, now I'm going to do my best race from here. I'm going to get the best possible time I can from this point, rather than doing this imaginary race of how I wanted it to go.
Yeah.
Do you typically go into races with multi-layered goals? I mean, is that something that you probably recommend your coaching clients to?
Every time, yeah. I mean, it's probably one of the most important pieces of advice that I give to the people I coach. It's important to have a stretch goal. You want to be ambitious. You want to challenge yourself, but not to just do that or bust. I mean, some people prefer that. They'd rather do 10 attempts at a marathon, knowing that 9 of them they'll blow up and 1 of them is going to be awesome. But it's not that fun, you know. That, and it's also guaranteeing you'll have a lot of bad days. So instead, if you're going for like a marathon PR, then that's your A goal. And then maybe close to that might be your B goal, or your second fastest time might be your B goal. But it's good to have several different goals and then to be flexible during the race. So in the 100 miler, for example, I've always finished Leadville under 17 hours. So that is a big deal to me. So even if I ended up coming fifth, if I break 17, that's still really motivating. But let's say the race is going a bit worse than I expect, and now my best case scenario is 17 and a half. I will say to myself, okay, well, I'm going to break 17 and a half by as much as I can. Maybe it's going to be 17:25, but I'm not going to let it slip to 18 and 19 right. Unless other things kind of out of my control happen. So I'm very much focused on, with the people I coach and with my own running, making sure that you can adapt during the race and that you're not just one goal or all the motivation seeps away.
Well, this would be a good time to tell you about this episode's sponsor, Health IQ. They offer low life insurance rates for marathon runners. Many runners don't realize that they can get a lower rate due to their health-conscious lifestyle. Health IQ is the only place where marathoners can get special rates on life insurance. They're a data and science-driven company that uses this data to negotiate lower rates on life insurance with A-plus insurance carriers. And here's the data that we're talking about.
Well, runners have a 45% lower risk of cardiovascular mortality compared to non-runners. You are also 87% less likely to be diabetic than a non-marathoner if you run 2 marathons per year. And you're 41% less likely to suffer from high blood pressure if you run 2 marathons a year.
You're low-risk customer for insurance companies if you're a runner. And Health IQ has used that knowledge to negotiate their rates. You can get a free life insurance quote if you go to healthiq.com/MTA. And you can also take one of their quizzes, which they're kind of known for. I took the marathon quiz, which tests how much people know about running marathons. So it's a lot of fun, and it all factors into how you can qualify for a lower life insurance rate. Head over to healthiq.com/MTA for a free quote on their life insurance for marathoners. That's healthiq.com/MTA, and we appreciate Health IQ being a sponsor of this podcast. Do you have any quotes that you like or mantras that you tell yourself when you're out there running?
I think the main one is that whenever I get negative thoughts, I try to find a counteracting positive one. Mm-hmm. So in something like a 100-miler where you know you're going to suffer, it's absolutely guaranteed no matter how fit you are. Firstly, I'm going to psych myself up for that. And so when it happens, instead of thinking, oh, my legs are tired, I'm exhausted, I don't want to keep going, why do I do this? I'll think, okay, this is why I do 100-milers, because this is what makes it valuable. Same in the marathon when you go through the wall. Yeah. You can tell yourself, this is why I'll care about the result afterwards, rather than thinking about the negatives of how you actually feel. And maybe your legs are sore, but you're moving forward at a decent pace. So instead of going on repeat in your head, legs are sore, I'm tired, I don't want to keep going, you say, I'm moving well. Even despite that, I'm moving well. Mm-hmm. And I'm on for my B goal. There's always something you can twist it around to basically spin a negative into a positive. Or maybe something's gone better than it did in another race. Or even at the worst case scenario, you could be thinking, well, I've had a worse race than this. Or I came through something tougher than this once. There's always some way that you can think of a positive spin to it. And that's what you've got to do, because it comes through then in your body language. It comes through in your mindset for the rest of the race. Someone who's given up, you can tell. The shoulders start slumping. Their head's down. And that body language is translating to their running motion. It's going to be slower. Everything's going to feel like more effort. Mm-hmm. If you can remain positive and also be thinking about your form and keep yourself upright, keep your shoulders relaxed, keep your arms swinging as normal, keep your cadence up, focus on these kind of things rather than the pain. And it just makes you feel more positive, makes everything feel better. And a good way of doing this actually is making sure that you don't go off too fast so that you can pace things well, because it's way more fun to spend the second half of a race catching people than spend the second half of the race gradually feeling worse and worse and having people zooming by you. And particularly in like a big city marathon, if you do even splits, you're basically going to be passing loads of people in the second half. And you're probably not going to get passed by really anyone. You know, you will just pass people and nothing else. If you go out too hard and you get a PR for the first half of the marathon and then you fade and you're slowing down, every time someone goes by you, it's another mental blow that's going to make it harder to keep moving. So it's another good reason for why you need to prioritize pacing and just hold yourself back that little bit early on to not get carried away with all the adrenaline at the beginning.
And it sounds like what you're saying, too, is when you hit a rough patch, control what you can. You know, you can control your mental attitude. You can control your face. You know, you could smile or make sure your shoulders relax, things like that, instead of getting totally bent out of shape that, you know, you're not hitting the pace that you want.
Yeah. Maybe. There's always going to be some things out of your control. Let's say it starts raining, the weather's bad, or your shoelace comes undone, or whatever it might be. Just fix everything that you can. And the stuff that's out of your control, just let it go. I mean, I think this is a very good general kind of stress management tactic in life anyway. If there's something you can't control that's stressing you out, just try to let it go and say, okay, well, for the moment, there's nothing I can do about that. It's just going to happen. So there's no point worrying about it and constantly thinking about it. It's something I find I use that the tactics from ultras to deal with things in normal life as well. That if something I can genuinely tell is out of my control, I will just try to let it go and say, there's no point getting stressed or annoyed about this because there's nothing I can do. So again, what you have in your control is your outlook. That's the thing that you can change. And that is such a huge part of distance running. And the longer the distance, the more important that becomes. And the less factor just your general fitness level will be relative to that.
Yeah, that's excellent.
I was listening to Tony Robbins recently, and he said he and his wife have the 90-second rule. Whenever there's a problem or something that they're stressed out about, they just think about it for 90 seconds. They let themselves panic for only that long, and then they move on.
It is so helpful. I mean, and again, with coaching people, I find that it's in some way more like counseling than it is just here are your running sessions. I mean, the majority of it is psychological and getting people mentally prepared for races. And that's what makes the biggest difference. It's one thing to turn up to a race start super fit. It's another thing to tap into that fitness and get the most out of it. And that's the secondary part of it that's much harder for most people, particularly when it gets to the point in the race where you could walk it in or you could jog it in, but instead you want to get your maximum performance for the day and push yourself to your limits. You've got to be able to keep that mental side sharp. And that largely comes down to really wanting it. You've got to do races that you're passionate about. So a road marathon, I mean, personally, I'd do any road marathon. It'll motivate me because even if it's a boring course, it's a fun, long, good quality run. For the harder, longer stuff, particularly 100 milers, I never recommend anyone to do one that they're not super excited and inspired about. And this would also apply, I suppose, to like a first-time marathoner. So pick something that you really, really want to do for the first one. So when it gets tough, you're much more motivated by it. Otherwise, when it gets to that point where it gets hard, you say, do I really care about this event? No, I think I'll just give up now.
Right. Yeah, that's very smart. Now, turning corner a little bit here, you race a lot. And so, you know, talk to us about what you do about recovery and injury prevention and things like that.
Very much related, those two, recovery and injury prevention, that if you overdo things, you're much more likely to get injured. So I'm very flexible with both my own training and with my clients about how they're feeling on the day. So I will know what the purpose of a training session is on a given day, and then I'll see how I'm feeling. So maybe a mile into it, if I can tell that I need a little bit more recovery or my body's not feeling as good as it should, I'm willing to alter the purpose of that run, usually to make it easier. Occasionally to make it harder, but the danger there is that you feel kind of better and you keep doing hard sessions until you don't feel good anymore. And that's not a good way to do it. So usually it's backing off and making sure that, you know, if I'm doing a long run, what am I trying to get out of it? It's to practice some particular elements of endurance. Maybe it's to have strong uphills in the second half or something like that. So if that purpose doesn't look feasible, then I'll back off and choose another day to do that. And it can be hard to do that, especially with long runs where most people are going to have to do that on the weekend. That's the only time it's going to fit in. But that's a benefit, maybe having the Saturday and Sunday with a bit of flexibility, that maybe you see how you're feeling on Saturday. And if you decide that has to be more of a recovery day, then you can do the long run on Sunday instead.
Any go-to, like, injury prevention, you know, maintenance stuff that you do, like foam rolling or...
So related to that as well is after a race, I'll be extra careful as well and allow as much recovery as I feel my body needs. I do foam roll, but I actually get weekly massage. So I've got a couple of different people I go to. So because it's two different sports masseurs, they just have slightly different styles, so they're going to work on slightly different things, which is really helpful. So I find that is one of the best ways to avoid the repetitive injuries you get from running. So, for example, tightness in the muscles from that repetitive movement then alters your biomechanics because it's restricting your motion, and then a lot of injuries stem from that. I'd actually say that a large proportion of running injuries are purely from tightness building up and then that leading to an injury. So it might be, for example, you have a sore left knee, but the real problem is you've got a tight right glute. So if you rest it, the knee gets better, but unless you get rid of that tightness, you still have that compromised biomechanics, and that injury comes right back. So that's where the foam rolling and the massage are extremely helpful. I also do a little warm-up set of exercise dynamic stretches before every run that I do. That helps both to get the blood pumping and therefore less injury on that day, as well as a little bit more long-term help with strength, flexibility, and stability. And usually about twice a week, I do a little bit of very simple core type stabilization work where I'm in an upright position, challenging my balance, for example, standing on one leg at a time and using free weights. So the benefit of doing stuff in the upright position is it's the same as when you're running. So your muscles are being used in a more similar way. And the benefit of challenging your balance and using free weights instead of machines is that it involves using all the stabilization muscles, not just the big power movements you're trying to do. So if you do, for example, a bicep curl on one arm, standing on one leg, you are not only working your bicep, you're working your core as it moves and changes your center of gravity. Your ankles are getting stronger. All these things that are specific to running a bit are benefiting. While if you do that same bicep curl on a bench and all of the stabilization is done for you, all you're working is your bicep, basically.
So let's talk about nutrition. We'd love to hear your thoughts on nutrition and what maybe some staple foods that you eat on a regular basis are.
Sure. I mean, my philosophy on this is very simple, which is that runners already put so much effort into their training, and we have to be quite anal about it. We have to be very disciplined and be willing to get out the door on days we don't want to.
Yeah.
So if your food also has that same level of sometimes it being a chore, then it takes a lot of the fun away from life in general. Mm-hmm. And you can eat healthily and eat nice foods and like have the occasional snack. I mean, if you can eat well, like 90% of the time, you can have some of those extra little things like I've got some cookies right next to bed right now. Particularly after a race, I allow myself to be a little bit more free with that kind of thing. But generally, to try and have non-processed stuff, to have fresh produce, to have a balanced diet. I don't have any specific unusual fad diet or anything like that. I'm not restricting myself to only certain types of food, but I'm just trying to avoid overly processed stuff and stuff that you know is not as healthy in general. But in terms of race nutrition, I then it's much more sugary stuff. It's the typical race foods to a large extent, gels, the jelly blocks. I use Clif Bar stuff mainly, and I use the organic energy food, which is like a baby food in a pouch. And that's so helpful in a 100-miler, particularly going uphill, to have something that's more like a paste rather than a more solid or sticky food. So in a race, it's largely race foods, and then I graze at the aid station. So I'll have maybe pieces of fruit, pretzel, whatever they seem to have out, and I fancy at the time, like M&M's, that kind of thing, just to get a little bit more variety that way and some different types of taste and texture as well. But the other benefit of these organic energy food pouches is they have savory flavors, and most race food is sweet. And particularly in a 100-miler, if you're stuffing sugar in your mouth all day long, your taste buds just get blown up. At the end of a race, I honestly can't taste things properly. Like I had a burger at the end of Leadville, and it was a delicious looking burger with avocado on it and bacon, and it was buffalo. And I tasted it and I went, this could be any type of food. I have no idea what this tastes like. So in general, though, I in terms of foods that I particularly try and get, there's two that I love, and so I fit them in a lot, and that's salmon, whether it's smoked salmon or cooked salmon, and also avocado. I have at least half an avocado every single day. And this isn't because I'm doing some kind of fitness freakish thing. It's because I like avocado. So ultimately, if you can find some healthy foods that you like, it's much easier to have them. I have a banana day as well. I kind of like bananas. So it's much easier to fit in a healthy lifestyle if you've got at least some super healthy stuff that is your go-to constantly.
Salmon and avocado and bananas. That sounds like our household.
not all together, but the salmon and the avocado.
They do.
Well, this has been great. Runners, like at the marathon level, who want to get stronger and increase their endurance, like what could they do in their training
I would say the simplest piece of advice, and this is what I'd always say to most people, if they're already training reasonably hard, especially if they're plateauing, is make sure that your recovery runs are super easy. Make sure you do allow enough recovery time. This is the thing that for your average, fairly consistent runner will make the biggest difference. For a beginner runner, maybe not as much, because they need to build things up. They need to have enough consistency in there to have more mileage, to be able to start doing harder sessions and to learn to be able to push themselves more. But for someone who's maybe done various races, they've been running for a few years, usually it's more a danger that they overdo things and that their recovery days are a little bit too fast. It's really important to make sure that rest and recovery days are focused just on helping your body to benefit from those harder sessions. So if you do a speed session today, you don't get fitter today. You've caused a stimulus where the muscle gets broken down, and then over the next few days, it rebuilds and is stronger. So if you don't allow that recovery, then you don't even benefit from the hard session. So that when people sometimes struggle to go out and hold themselves back enough for a recovery run, I tell them to think of it more as what they're doing there is they're not wasting all that hard effort they put in maybe the day before. And that's an easier sell. If you're saying to them, you worked hard already and you don't want that to go down the drain and be useless or maybe leave you injured, then it's much easier to back off today and allow yourself to get that benefit. But I think that's probably the simplest thing that can make a big difference. And having that flexibility as well to ask yourself during each run, are you feeling as you'd expect to? Do you need to back off? Do you need to alter what sessions you're doing this week to allow enough recovery time?
Yeah, that's excellent advice.
So are you ever going to grow a gnarly ultra beard?
I couldn't. No, I would look very wispy and it would mainly just be a goatee.
Yeah, me too.
You guys are
I don't think you need it. It's not like Samson needing his hair for the strength. I always find it kind of funny seeing, particularly North American races where there's a lot more bearded runners. And when you see like a big international race and you've got some American, some European, and the American guys are like all bearded. They're wearing a Czech shirt on the podium. They've got short shorts. And then you've got the Europeans and it's like compression gear head to toe, all Lycra. Neatly trimmed beards and everything like that. So it's there's definitely a cultural contrast there. But I don't think I'd want to grow a beard even if I could.
Hey, let's get your top picks on gear real quick. I think you're sponsored by Ultra, right?
Yes.
So any thoughts on Ultra shoes? Angie has a pair. I've never run in them, but...
I love them. I mean, the whole point is that they've got a foot-shaped toe box so that, unlike a lot of shoes that are really narrow and they taper, which looks nice, they're not squishing your feet. So I've actually found that since I switched to Ultras, I have basically no blisters after 100 miler, while I used to have them a lot more because my toes are being pushed together and so they're rubbing a lot more. So I love that aspect of them. I mean, I switched over to Ultra purely for that feature. And then on top of that, they happen to be really good at making shoes now, and they're improving in all the time. They keep building on it. But the two shoes in particular that I love for the trail, the Lone Peak, and the current version is version 3. That's what I did Leadville in. It's just such a well-made shoe. It's really sturdy, but it's super flexible and you can really feel the ground while also being protected from it. So I love the Lone Peak. And then for the roads, I tend to use the 1. So the version of that, I think, is the 1 2.5 at the moment. And it's just basically a lightweight racer. There are maybe a few lighter weight racing flats out there, but it's a marginal difference. But again, nice feel to it, and there's enough cushioning for a road. So I would do, even if I was doing like a 100-mile road race, I would use that one instead of something more cushioned.
And once you go to the wider toe box, you don't want to squish your foot into a narrow shoe again.
No, it's so weird. I kept a load of the shoes that I used to have, thinking, you know, over time it's nice to have a bit of variety. Every time I put them on, it's, oh, this feels weird and it hurts. It's like it's on the widest part of my foot, it's just pressing a little bit. And the toes certainly feel like they're pressed. But yeah, I mean, that's the benefit of having gear that you can trust. Any race that you do, the most important thing is comfort for your shoes in particular. So, you know, whatever shoes you wear, whatever features they have, that's all well and good, but they have to feel comfortable first. So that is always my priority. And I will race in the shoes that feel the most comfortable, particularly in a 100 miler where you don't want to be having pinch points or annoying little aspects of it. Even if there's some elements of it, like maybe it's got bigger lugs or this or that, that might be useful for some elements of a particular race. If the shoe doesn't feel comfortable in the first place, then it's basically useless.
I've seen some ultra runners cut out their toe box.
I've seen it late in a race, particularly maybe things like Badwater, where they're running on a road. I wouldn't recommend doing that on a trail. It's a little bit more difficult to do then. You might stub your feet a little bit.
So where would people go if they want to check out what you're doing and what you're up to and connect with you?
Very easy. So I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all of them. It's Charman Ian, so Sharman, Ian Charmanian. And then my coaching website, which includes links to everything as well, is SharmanUltra.com.
All right. Fantastic. Well, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you for providing so much valuable content and advice for our listeners. And congrats again on your Leadville victory this year.
Thank you. Yeah, it's always fun chatting about running, and that's why I made it my career about 5 or 6 years ago. So I have conversations like this all day long with my coaching clients. It's great.
Huh. Nice. So any other races on your calendar for this year?
I'll do a couple of road marathons, so some stuff a little bit more local. I might do maybe another 50K, but I had intended to do one more 100 miler, which had been 4 this year. 3, I think, is enough. So I'm going to leave that.
That's I agree. I think 3 would be enough for me. All right. Well, rock on, man. And you're an inspiration. And thanks for jumping on the podcast with us again this year.
Thanks for all the information you guys provide through it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ian Charman. We appreciate him being back on the podcast. And we'll be sure to link to him and everywhere he is online over with the show notes to this episode. Angie, when we were talking to him, did you kind of walk down memory lane and recall running the Leadville Trail Marathon? Did it bring back some nightmares?
No, it just brings up a whole lot of admiration because, I mean, I did 26.2 miles on it, and the thought of doing 100 miles is pretty mind-blowing. So I have great respect for
it's rugged country.
Anyone who runs, Yeah, the Leadville 100 miler.
Yeah. Leadville just got this awesome vibe. And one thing I enjoyed about going there, it's an historic place, you know, this old mining town. I don't know, it's got this lore about it. But the Leadville race series, because there's more than just a marathon and 100 mile, there's other distances, and also they do some bike races. But it's really got a big presence there in Leadville, and there's the official Leadville store where you can go, and like it's like a running store, but everything's branded Leadville 100, Leadville Marathon, Leadville this and that. So it was like, it almost felt like a pilgrimage, you know, to ultra marathon holy ground going there. Is that a little bit too over the top of in a description?
Yes. I think it was a lack of oxygen getting to your brain.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's some places that feel like that for runners, like sacred places, like the Boston Marathon finish line, right? Everyone should go and see it. Well, in this episode's quick tip, we want to recommend a pair of sandals that actually help deal with plantar fasciitis and promote recovery after a run. So I'm going to let Angie tell you what they are and how we discovered them.
Yes, they are called UFOS, and I actually discovered them. A coaching client of mine recommended them to me, and she was using them for her plantar fasciitis. And at the time, I had been dealing with some of that over the summer, and I thought, I need to try these out because they sound too intriguing to pass up. Mm-hmm. And I bought a pair and pretty much have not taken them off since. Definitely takes sandals to the next level. They're really shock absorbent. They reduce stress on your foot. They enable a natural walking motion and just super comfortable. And they definitely do help with plantar fasciitis, wow, at least in my case. So yes, I'm recommending to everyone who is still stuck wearing the traditional unsupported flip-flops and that they need to take their shoe choices to the next level and actually doing something good for their foot.
So once again, that's UFOS. And I guess that's because when you put them on, you get that, ooh, that feels good. And we'll link to that on our website. And if you happen to get a pair, tell them that you heard about them on our podcast. That'd be a big help. Well, that's it. Thank you so much for being a listener. It's always fun to connect with you. If you want to send us a message through our website, we'd love to help you train to achieve your goals and whatever distance you're training for. We have folks who are training for their first half and also some that are training for their first ultra. So wherever you are at in your journey, if we can be of help to you, check us out online at marathontrainingacademy.com. And of course, we want you to remember you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way.